Hello, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we explore and analyze who and what has been making news at Iowa State Capitol, including the governor and legislation that's in the works, legislation that could be in the works, and what it means for all of us. I'm Dennis Hart, and I'm joined as always by Laura Bellin of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, I say this every week, and I mean it. It is good to be with you after another busy week at the Capitol.
It's always good to be here, Dennis.
Well, we should start with what's made news this afternoon, Laura. The state Senate has reported another case of the coronavirus. Let's unpack that. What do we know?
We don't know a lot. We know that the person tested positive on April 10th, and the person was supposedly last in the Iowa Senate on April 7th. We don't know whether it's a state senator, a member, a clerk, a legislative staff, or a lobbyist. We also don't know whether the person was wearing a mask the whole time the person was at the Capitol on April 7th. And remember last week there was a new case announced in the Iowa House. We don't know whether there's any connection between those people.
So this makes two cases that we're aware of, I believe, in the Senate, but the House has had seven coronavirus cases confirmed.
That seven that we know about, they're not required to disclose them. So we can hope that people, if they test positive, have been reporting that to the House and Senate leadership, but they're not
right.
Required.
Well,
to
we wish everybody the best, obviously, in the House and the Senate. And we're going to get into what those two bodies were doing last week. But first, Governor Reynolds made a whole lot of news last week. For starters, she said the state has been asked to take in some migrant children who have showed up at the nation's border with Mexico. We all know what's going on down in Mexico. But Governor Reynolds said it was not Iowa's problem. She said it's President Biden's problem. Let's talk about that a little bit. That seems like a rather, to a fair-minded observer, harsh indictment or dismissal, if you will.
It really did. And I asked the Iowa Department of Human Services for the correspondence that occurred between the state and federal officials, and it really wasn't very enlightening. I mean, the federal officials asked the DHS director, they said, we're reaching out to all of the states to find out, could you provide temporary housing for these unaccompanied migrant children in federal custody? And the DHS director just said, we don't have the resources to accept any children at this time. But it really wasn't explained. And a lot of people were very upset, especially people old enough to remember Governor Bob Rae in the 1970s. When Iowa, of course, welcomed so many refugees from Southeast Asia. But I think what was particularly upsetting to a lot of people was that the governor didn't even ask whether Iowans would step up to support. I think if the governor had said, our state has been asked to provide temporary shelter for some children who are now being housed at the border in bad conditions, I think a lot of Iowans and some, especially certain faith communities, would have stepped up and said that they were happy to contribute to help provide that shelter. So that was disappointing just to hear that Iowa had said no before Iowans were even asked to pitch in.
I think what ticked some people off as well is the way that she said it, that it dismissed it as it's not this state's problem, it's the president's problem. Well, it seems as if to a lot of observers, fair-minded observers, it's the nation's problem.
It is. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the crisis at the border and Biden's crisis at the border. I mean, there is a seasonal effect that every spring, as the weather gets warmer, there are more migrants and people trying to cross the border. And according to some accounts, there's been more of that this year, but really it's something that's been cyclical and seasonal, and it's occurred for a long time. So it's not that this was some, you know, unforeseeable idea. And I think it's reasonable for states to step up and help. And it's really hard to see how Iowa wouldn't be able to at least give shelter to some of the children. And I mean, nobody wants to see kids in terrible conditions sleeping on the floor with foil blankets. So, I mean, I think that in any way that states could help, it would reflect well on the whole country.
Governor also made some front page news last week when she vowed at a news conference to prohibit so-called vaccine passports in Iowa. Now, let's download that just a little bit. There is no move on the part of the federal government, none whatsoever on the part of the Biden administration, to implement anything approaching vaccine passports. But this seems to have become part of the culture wars that Republicans in many states are engaged in, the idea of passports for people to get into places to show that they've been vaccinated. So she vowed to prohibit them, though there's no move to get them.
Yeah, what it reminds me of, a parallel thing happening this month that a lot of Republican politicians are involved in is calling April meat on the table month and declaring that they're going to fight the Democrats' war on meat and so on when there is no war on meat. I mean, what policies are they even talking about that supposedly would be against meat? And this is very similar. I mean, no one's proposed to require vaccine passports. The Biden administration hasn't proposed it. Congress hasn't proposed it. And I found it interesting because when the governor lifted the mask mandate, well, we never really had a mask mandate, but to the extent that we had a partial mask requirement in certain settings, when the governor lifted that, she said, you know, businesses can still require masks if they want to. And there have been some businesses that have continued to require masks. So I view this idea of a vaccine passport. I mean, it's really not, it wouldn't be like a document issued by the government, but I view that as an idea that a business could say, well, look, if you want to dine indoors, we'd like to see evidence that you've been vaccinated because we're trying to keep our patrons safe or some such thing. But it seems like maybe the governor wants to prohibit even businesses from requiring that of their clients. It's not really clear.
And that's really where the push, if there has been any, for these passports has come from. As you know, it's from corporations, businesses who may want to ensure the safety of their customers inside. But as you know, in the last week or so, or more than that, Republicans have come out against big business in many respects, for pulling the All-Star game, baseball game out of Atlanta, for speaking out against the Georgia voting laws, etc. So it seems as if right now Republicans are focusing on what used to be their big allies, big business.
Yeah, it's a strange situation. And again, I don't know what the Republican politicians can do to stop businesses from requiring this. One of my brothers is a big travel guy, and he was telling me recently that the cruise lines are starting to gear up to restart some of the cruises, and they're starting to announce that everyone is going to be required to have a COVID-19 vaccine to be a passenger on a cruise. I mean, I think that would be logical. I've never been on a cruise myself, but it seems like a reasonable business decision. So what's the government going to do? Tell these cruise lines that they can't require that? I mean, that seems very strange. And the businesses taking a stand against some of the laws, whether they're laws targeting LGBTQ people or election restrictions, I mean, we've been told by the Supreme Court and others that corporate spending is speech and that corporations are persons under the law. So I don't really know why is it a problem that corporations are speaking out against some of these policies?
It is indeed hard to see how the state of Iowa, for example, could ban a cruise line from requiring a passport, but that's another question perhaps for another show, and we will have more shows to discuss this, I'm sure. Governor also made some news last week. She helped a faith-based school raise money by letting it auction off a dinner at the governor's mansion. You have written about this extensively in the last few days because it has raised numerous eyebrows and some questions, so let's download that now.
Well, I was very interested in this story because a couple of months ago, Ryan Foley of the Associated Press reported that Governor Reynolds in 2019 had auctioned off her time, a lunch and a tour of the Capitol and several hours with her to raise money for a charity led by the couple who started Iowa Select Farms. This is one of the biggest hog producer companies, and this couple has combined donated about $300,000 to the governor's campaign. So that one really raised eyebrows. You know, why is the governor selling access to support a charity that's affiliated with her donors? And her staff said at that time, well, she supports lots of charities. She's done this for lots of charities. And I've asked for the list of which charities have benefited from this kind of a donation of the governor's time, and I haven't received that list. But the staff told Ryan Foley a couple of months ago that the governor paused that a practice during the pandemic. So this was the first time I had heard of the governor allowing a nonprofit to auction a meal at Terrace Hill, which is the taxpayer-supported, state-owned governor's residence, to support a private religious school in Des Moines. And, you know, I think there are a lot of questions about whether that's even legal to do that. One of the questions I have is who's going to pay for the food and the staffing costs of that dinner? Because the Iowa Constitution says that public resources can't be used for private purposes.
So where does this story go from here? Is this a one-day wonder, or does this have legs?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm still trying to find out. First of all, I'm trying to find out who the winning bidder was. The dinner for eight at Terrace Hill with the governor and her husband went for $30,100 at this auction. That's quite a bit of money to pay for an experience. It's, I'm also wondering whether the people in that dinner party are going to be required to be vaccinated for COVID-19. Because if they're not, I mean, we know that indoor dining is a risk for spread, and I'm wondering how the staff at Terrace Hill are going to be kept safe. And I'm still trying to find out who solicited this donation. I didn't find any record of any campaign contributions from board members of this Des Moines Christian School to the governor, but I'm wondering, for instance, whether the governor has any contact or perhaps any friends or staff members who have children who attend this school. So I'm trying to find out, and also just trying to find out what other schools and religious organizations the governor has supported in this way. I mean, I think that's a list that should be publicly available. So I'm going to be making more records requests in that area.
Let me just say this. If you and your husband come up to Ames to have dinner with my wife and me, it will not cost you $30,000, Laura.
Well, that's good to know, since we don't have $30,000. The funny thing was, that wasn't actually even the top ticket item at that auction. They were auctioning off coveted parking places that were conveniently located near the school, and the parking spot number one went for over $44,000. The governor at Terrace Hill was second for $30,000.
It would definitely cost $44,000 to park near our place, though, so you'd have to have that money. Okay, we'll be following this one. And the other news came from other sources last week. Obviously, the state Supreme Court weighed in when it said it was going to try to stick as closely as possible to Iowa's current nonpartisan redistricting system if the Federal Census Bureau delays the state to force missing a constitutional deadline. So what does this mean? What do we mean about this? What does the Supreme Court mean by this? And what could it mean for all of us?
Well, this was a little bit of a strange statement, and I published the Iowa Supreme Court's full unsigned statement on my website on Saturday. But the Iowa Constitution sets a deadline that the new state legislative districts need to be adopted by September 15th of the year following the census year. And if that September 15th deadline hasn't been met, the Iowa Supreme Court assumes responsibility for having the maps drawn. And normally that's not an issue. I mean, in 2011, we were already well on the way to having a new plan passed, and by mid-April that legislature had already approved the new plan and the governor signed it on April 19th. But of course, we don't even have the population data from the Census Bureau yet. So there's no way that the state is going to meet the September 15th deadline, because we're not even going to have the numbers. And it's been clear for months that these numbers weren't going to be available in time to have the new maps drawn and have the legislature vote on the maps before September 15th. So people, including me, have been asking the Iowa Supreme Court, how are you going to approach this? And we've consistently been told the court doesn't comment on future cases until all of a sudden on Thursday, this statement appeared. And it was, I would have to say, it was fairly ambiguous. I mean, I would have preferred something that was a little more clear about how they see the process playing out. It's what the court wants to see: a nonpartisan redistricting process that is very close to what the current law outlines. That involves a nonpartisan commission drawing maps, and it also involves the legislature voting on those maps. But what's not clear is whether the court wants the legislature to vote on the maps, even if this all occurs after September 15th. And the statement said that, you know, this is our tentative plans, but it's not legally binding. So it made clear that it sounded like they reserve the right to take full control of this process. But I got the impression that they would prefer to have the legislature vote on a set of maps that was drawn by this nonpartisan commission, but also that they're very concerned that this outcome be a nonpartisan outcome. I read that statement to imply that the Iowa Supreme Court does not want to be part of any Republican gerrymander of the state.
So we'll wait and see what happens on that one. The state Supreme Court will weigh in, perhaps, perhaps not.
We'll find out this fall.
We will indeed. It is 15 minutes past the hour, and you are listening to KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart, and that young lady is Laura Bellin of the must-read blog site Bleeding Heartland. We're talking about what went on at the state capitol last week, and a lot went on in the state Senate, which, among other things, passed a revised version of a proposed constitutional amendment that says the state constitution does not secure the right to an abortion. Plenty to download on this one. Let's start.
Well, this has been a little bit of a mystery to me this year, and the mystery started to be revealed a little bit last week. So the Iowa Senate had already approved a version of this abortion constitutional amendment last year. The amendment says that the Iowa Constitution doesn't provide any right to an abortion or funding to an abortion. And this was designed to overturn a 2018 Iowa Supreme Court ruling that said the Iowa Constitution does protect the right to an abortion. Last year, the Iowa House didn't have enough Republican votes to pass this amendment, and so it died. They had to go back and start all over. And this year, with a larger Republican majority, they passed this amendment right away before the end of January. So I expected the Senate to move on it right away, and instead, they sat on it for 2.5 months. And here's, I think, the reason. The Iowa Senate had approved the following language last year: to defend the dignity of all human life and to protect mothers and unborn children from efforts to expand abortion even to the day of birth, we, the people of the state of Iowa, declare that this constitution shall not be construed to recognize, grant, or secure a right to abortion or to require the public funding of abortion. Now, when the Iowa House approved that amendment earlier this year, they had a slightly shorter version. The effect would be the same, that legally it would do the same thing, but this is the wording the Iowa House approved. To defend and protect unborn children, we, the people of the state of Iowa, declare that this constitution does not recognize, grant, or secure a right to an abortion or to require the public funding of abortion. So that's the version that passed the House. And the Senate, I expected the Senate to simply pass that House version, but instead last week they adopted an amendment to substitute their wording from last year. So now it has to go back to the House, and it's on the debate calendar now for the House. And so we'll see whether the House Republicans go along with the Senate wording or whether they try to go back to the wording they approved in January. And I'm not really sure why this hasn't been aired publicly, why the Senate and House Republicans haven't been able to agree on wording, but that seems to be the sticking point.
Now, even if both houses do approve the same language.
It was a very long debate in the Senate.
Even if both houses do approve the same language, it's still a long way from getting to voters' ballots. Let's talk about that.
Yes. Yeah, so what would need to happen, the Iowa Constitution is very difficult to amend compared to some states. So two separately elected legislatures have to approve identical language. And so it is important to agree on language the first time and get it right, because they need to pass, both chambers have to pass the same language either this year or next year, and then after the 2022 election, both chambers would have to pass the same language again in either 2023 or 2024 to get this measure on the what presumably it would be the 2024 general election ballot. Although there's an interesting rumor floating around that Republicans might try to schedule a vote on this amendment for a different time, not at a general election time, for a different date when there might be lower turnout. So the Constitution doesn't require them to schedule votes on a constitutional amendment to coincide with the November election. That's generally what's been done, but it's not required. But in any case, 2023 or 2024 would be the earliest that this could come before Iowa voters. And right now, the opinion polls suggest that most Iowans don't support this idea of amending the Constitution to say that there's no right to an abortion.
So apparently, according to that rumor that you have just put out to many people who are listening here, Republicans would like to have a lower turnout potentially for this particular issue.
Well, it's possible. I mean, this hasn't been officially announced, but it's been floated that if this passes two separately elected legislatures, that they might designate that it be voted on at a different time, not to coincide with the 2024 November election. So there have been at least two constitutional amendments. This happened decades ago, a long time ago, but there have been times when Iowans voted on a constitutional amendment to coincide with the June primary. But it's even possible that the legislature, if they want to, they could designate really any time. They could designate it to coincide with the local elections for school boards and city councils in November 2023 if they wanted to. Or, I mean, they could set a completely separate day. The Constitution just says that the legislature has to set a date for the people of Iowa to vote. And typically that's been done to coincide with a November election because that's when turnout is highest. And so you, in theory, you want the largest number of people to have a say on whether we change our state's founding document.
Right. Okay, the Senate was busy last week. It passed a bill that would revise the state's mental health funding system, phase out property tax replacement payments to local governments, and ensure that Iowans see a series of tax cuts starting in 2023. Not bad in terms of that kind of busyness. So it's the second major tax cut package Senate Republicans have passed in less than a month. Let's talk about this.
This repeated some of the provisions from the previous one that we talked about a few weeks ago that passed unanimously. And I think that signals that the Iowa House Republicans probably aren't interested in acting on that earlier bill that passed the Senate unanimously because they repeated some of the same provisions. So regarding the triggers, the state revenue triggers that would be required to allow certain other income tax cuts that were approved in 2018 to go into effect. But this property tax business is going to be very controversial, and I'll be interested to see where it goes in the House. I do not expect the House to approve this bill without any amendments, because changing the property taxes, changing the mental health funding system in itself is a big tangled idea. And there are people in the mental health community, there are supporters of disengaging this from property taxes, and then there are also people who worry because property taxes have been a fairly stable source of funding. And if it becomes a state-funded program, then, you know, there's less of a guarantee that it will stay at a certain level. So that was something that some of the Democratic senators raised last week. Senator Joe Bolcom, who's the ranking member of Appropriations, he said that this bill breaks a promise that the Iowa legislature made in 2013 when they said that the state would backfill and support local budgets for the money they lost from the commercial property tax cut that passed in 2013. And so this takes away that backfill money, and that now it makes a new promise that the state is going to provide secure mental health funding. But how do we know that in 5 years or 8 years or 10 years that the state won't decide that they don't want to fund this mental health services anymore at that level? So there's going to be a big battle over this one, and it's a very complex bill. So I think that it'll probably be whatever the legislature does with property taxes will probably be one of the last things that passes before they adjourn this year. That was what happened in 2013. Several big bills were tied together, including this large commercial property tax cut, and it took weeks to negotiate that.
I mentioned earlier that it was the second major bill cutting taxes. Earlier, the Senate had unanimously passed a bill to eliminate Iowa's inheritance tax.
Yes, that one was a surprise that the Democrats went along with it, but they felt that the analysis of the inheritance tax in Iowa was that unlike the estate tax at the federal level, which really only affects very, very wealthy people, the inheritance tax was often hitting a lot of middle income Iowans because it was a tax on the people who inherit, who receive the money, not a tax on the estates. And they also felt that the Senate Democrats felt that this was unfair to Iowans in non-traditional family structures, LGBTQ Iowans, because the current Iowa inheritance tax exempts children and grandchildren, but it doesn't exempt other people, other extended family or friends who people might leave estates to. And there are a lot of older LGBTQ Iowans who didn't have children because it wasn't socially acceptable during the time that they were young. And so if they want to leave their estates to other people, it would be subject to this tax. So in any case, the House has not moved on that, I think, because they're a little concerned about the price tag. Phasing out the inheritance tax would cost about $90 million to $100 million in revenue a year. And I'm just not sure that the House Republicans, they seem to be a little bit more cautious than the Senate Republicans when it comes to reducing revenues.
As we said, that one passed unanimously, and the Senate also passed another bill unanimously last week. This one setting up a system of grants for broadband providers. It's an effort to boost internet access in various parts of the state. Now, that bill had also passed the House in a unanimous vote the week before. You've written about this one, and so I think you have some asides on this one that may not be perhaps as rosy as it was put out to be.
The broadband bill was interesting because sometimes when the final vote on legislation is unanimous, it can conceal that there were really significant political disagreements while this bill was being drafted. And this was a good example. So the governor has asked for a massive investment in broadband expansion that would be $450 million over 3 years. It's really a very significant chunk of the state budget to try to get high-speed internet to underserved areas in Iowa, which is a large number of counties, mostly rural counties. But there are even areas in urban counties that are poorly served by high-speed internet. So this program, the bill that passed last week doesn't have any funding attached to it, but it sets up the structure of broadband grants. They would be administered by the Office of Chief Information Officer. And the idea of creating these broadband grants is popular, and that's why the final vote was a unanimous vote. But the Democrats, led by former minority leader Janet Peterson, she had an amendment that said, let's make sure that the Office of Chief Information Officer adopts rules that require this service to be affordable. So people whose individual income or household income is no greater than 150% of the federal poverty level, let's make sure that those people have access to affordable internet. And the Republicans voted down that amendment. So what may end up happening is that the state could invest a lot of money in laying down fiber and getting broadband to a lot of underserved areas. And then a lot of the residents living in those areas may not be able to afford the hookup, because a lot of rural counties in Iowa have high poverty levels and have relatively low incomes compared to, say, Polk County or Story County or Johnson County or Linn County. So I think we'll see how it plays out. And again, we don't know how much the state is really going to put toward broadband. It's possible Congress will pass an infrastructure bill that has a lot of money to support broadband. But the Democrats in the Senate were saying, let's set up something similar to the way LIHEAP works. Let's make sure that people with lower incomes have affordable access to this broadband, and it didn't get into the final bill.
We have a couple of minutes left for this particular Capitol Week. Republicans in the House last week were proposing, an education budget in which Iowa's public universities, which seem to have been whiplashed this year in the state legislature, would see a tuition freeze and no allocation increase. Now, some folks are saying this is another one of those things where they're sending a message to state universities about their unhappiness with what's going on campuses with conservative students. How do you read this?
I don't know. I mean, I think when we're getting close to the end of the session, so a budget bill, I think, is stronger than just sending a message. And people involved in higher education in Iowa have been complaining for the last 10 years that the state legislature has been underfunding education. But the double whammy in this bill is that they would also bar the Board of Regents from adopting a tuition increase to make up for some of the lost revenue. So it really seems like it could be difficult for Iowa State and the University of Iowa and the University of Northern Iowa to even balance their budgets if they're not, I mean, enrollment has declined somewhat. And if they can't raise tuition and the state's share of their budget is not increasing, that's going to be a real problem.
Yeah. When I said sending a message, the message being we don't like what's going on college campuses.
Right. But I mean, there's a lot of students, and they're not just Democratic students. And a lot of the business community relies on these strong university towns. I mean, those are big job generators and wealth generators for our state.
One bill I just have to mention in the last minute here, in the House last week, lawmakers passed an alcohol delivery bill that was touted as one that could help Iowans stay home during the coronavirus. It would allow third-party delivery of alcohol. It would allow them to stay home during the coronavirus pandemic because we wouldn't have to go anywhere to get the alcohol. That strikes me as quite a bill.
I mean, last June, the legislature approved a bill to allow takeout cocktails to go. That had not been legal before the pandemic. I don't know whether this one has legs. I'm not sure this one is going to get to the governor, this third-party delivery. There's a lot of details to iron out still in that. It seems like that could be ripe for abuse.
Yes. 15 seconds, Laura. What do you expect this week?
Oh, I think more discussions of the budget. It's getting, like I said, getting close to the end. And so we're going to hear more about the budget. And the Iowa House is probably going to go back and debate that abortion amendment as well.
Laura, we are out of time. A pleasure being with you again today. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, Dennis.
And it'll cost less than $30,000 to have dinner with my wife and me. I just want to reassure you. Laura and I are going to be right back here in this time slot next week for Capitol Week on KHOI Community Radio, with a look at what makes news with the governor and with the Iowa State Legislature this week and what it means for all of us. Until then, thank you so very much for the privilege of your time, and we hope you have a great week.